in here. I'll say that for it.
It's working. Usually it goes out on this kind of weather.
Well, we have an interesting problem today. And, of course, it's one of those situations that will never be solved to everyone's satisfaction. But we begin with a very basic question. And that is, why are we here? What is humanity's reason for existence? Well, there are many schools of thought over the periods of time as to why all this happened. And probably the Greeks had one approach, that the powers that be, the deities of Olympus, having created a beautiful garden here, put human beings down here to take care of it and to enjoy it as much as possible, to take good care of all values and never to become destructive in their relationships. Something went wrong with the plan. A little later, perhaps, Aesop answered the question as to why humanity exists, and he took the position that it was a test of stamina. In other words, the gods had as their principal occupation the casting down of the great and the lifting up of the lowly. Well, that had considerable meaning back in those days, but it isn't as vital now because the lowly do not seem to be coming up as rapidly as they should. So this theory was cast aside. And then we came into the conditions that arose with the Protestant Reformation in Europe. The school children of that time were given a little doggerel to recite. With Adam's fall, we sinned us all. That seemed to take care of everything. But again, there were doubters. Everyone was not satisfied. Then we were here to expiate original sin. With Adam's fall, we sinned us all. That hasn't retained popularity either. So day by day, different periods and different appointments and different philosophies have worked with the problem. Science, in a sense, has cut the Gordian knot. A scientific point of view seems to be there is no reason. And we are simply a product of a continuing failure of, we might say, the staying of the growth of humanity. In other words, as some of the friars of the Middle Ages said, the only answer to this is that everyone will stop propagating their kind, and in one generation humanity will cease and it will all be over. Well, that had attraction for some, but the outlying districts never came in. And so that was put aside as one of the speculations. So we are left with a series of philosophical and theological explanations and a scientific situation in which it is all biological, and the inevitable expansion of humanity will continue until the planet will no longer protect or carry them. All of these are unsatisfactory answers. And as far as the books are concerned, we probably never will have an answer that everyone agrees on. But we can, with a certain amount of effort, begin to examine things. And that is the reason we have chosen for a subject this morning, an invitation to insight. We must each, in a certain sense at least, solve these problems for ourselves. We must come to our own conclusions as to why things are as they are and what the chances of their getting better actually can be considered. Well, insight is a combination of the use of resources within the individual. Perhaps the answer to it all is that we were put here to learn how to think. to learn how to live well and to reform the mistakes of our own forebears and our own present errors of thinking. Insight depends upon two faculties in the human mental equipment. One is the group of faculties which are called the practical or expressive faculties of observation. We are given the power to observe what is happening in the world around us. We can observe every type of phenomena that exists within the range of our perceptions. We can also go through life observing all these things and coming to no valid solution to anything. In other words, we can see almost everything there is to see. But to most people, what they see does not mean anything, unless it happens to be something they are desperately wanting to see. We do not use the powers of perception which we have in order to find some type of depth dimension in our observations. In other words, we are constantly confronted with lessons, and we are, with the same constancy, avoiding them, failing to see or accept. We go from day to day living largely upon our own notions. If we like things, they're good. If we do not like them, they're bad. If they require a great deal of thinking, we will pay someone else to do it for us. And as they probably did not know any more than we do, the bill is high and the consequences are very minimal. We do not use the faculties of observation. Everything that happens is more than just a picture moving by. It is a compound of living factors. We see the consequences of badly run business organizations and the sign of bankruptcy that appears finally on the door. But this means nothing to us except somebody went bankrupt. It has no bearing upon our lives. We do not observe the causes, the reasons, and the circumstances associated with the phenomena we observe every day. Now, in addition to this, we have another group of faculties, which are called the reflectives. These faculties are the meaning faculties. They are the things that, within our own structure, that induce us to contemplate, to consider, and to philosophize upon the common circumstances of the day. The eyes tell us what's happening. The reflective faculties try to explain to us what these happenings mean to us every day. Evidently, we were supposed to do something in this area, or we would not have been given this allotment of faculties. We would not have powers to see what is happening and to think about what is happening unless these happenings had some meaning, some value beyond what we commonly consider. So in our daily living as private citizens, it is not necessary for us to depend upon any of the grand solutions that solve nothing. It is not necessary to follow any system which is based upon merely attitudes rather than reflections and considerations of facts. Bacon refers to the idols of the marketplace, and this is a very good observation. The marketplace is the common world in which we live. The idols of the marketplace are the attitudes, beliefs, and opinions which we cling to because they are held by those in the marketplace. We feel that the marketplace sets the standard which we must all live by. Whatever is believed by the merchant must be believed by the rest of us. Whatever is important to the man trying to make money is important to the individual who would like to try to make money. And that covers most folks before it's over. But the idols of the marketplace are the attitudes, opinions, legislations, policies, and concepts with which we are constantly bombarded. And these are the idols which are not of any valid significance, but they take the place of ideals. An ideal is a concept that is held with reverence. An idol is something that is worshipped for profit in most cases. So the idols are, we've always done it this way, so we'll keep on doing it. We've had legislations for this, so we'll keep on legislating some more. We have managed to wander through a number of economic crises by old-fashioned policies, so we will continue to wander through, but we won't solve anything. So the idols of the marketplace become the symbols of the practical policies that we are all trying to live by. And for the most part, these policies result in a series of disillusionments. Every day it becomes more obvious to us that these policies are not sufficient. They're not getting us where we want to go. They're not providing us with any securities. And they are not answering any of the questions that come up to us in the course of human anxieties. A recent issue of the Christian Science Monitor has a very interesting and informative article on the Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan. Now, we might not expect everyone to know where Bhutan is, but it is squeezed in the foothills of the Himalaya Mountains between India and China. It is a country of about 18,000 square miles, with a population of somewhere between 2 and 3 million. It is a Buddhist country, and the last stronghold of Buddhist theocracy, I guess, in the world today. Even here, the theocratic aspect has been minimized, and the present king, a young man with very modern attitudes, is desperately trying to bring his country into some form of stability. The point of view is very basic. Bhutan is now, according to the official statements, about to join the 20th century. And they are very uncertain as to whether they're going to survive this joint. Because the moment they come into the 20th century, the Chinese have their eye on them on one side, the Hindus have their eye on them on the opposite side, and all nations with importing and exporting interests have both eyes on them. These people lived quietly in a sheltered little kingdom. They had no money to speak of, but they had no poverty, practically, because everyone was equally indigent but comfortable. They were ruled over by a rather benevolent young man, who apparently was very much interested in trying to keep the country on its feet. Up to that time, it had been completely ruled by the Buddhist monks. It was a Buddhist country. These Buddhist monks still have a great deal to say about the management of the country, but it is now a sort of a mutual agreement between the religious and secular governments. Bringing this country into the modern world is almost like bringing a newborn babe into modern society. Everyone's very happy at the thought, and with a little more serious thinking, everyone starts to worry. And this is true. To meet this emergency, the Bhutanese people have decided to open the country on the India side and are building roads. They have already received grants from various funds for national improvements and so on, and they are trying desperately to establish an enduring state and hold its independence, although they are reasonably certain they can't do it. But at the same time, they are being led now by a very young but very optimistic fellow who is a graduate of the University of California, and he's gone back to help them plan an agricultural expansion program. So there's movement and anxiety and trouble. And this little independent country is gradually recognizing that it is about on the edge of being swallowed up by something bigger than itself, and against which it will have no protection whatsoever. Now, this type of problem makes us wonder a little bit as to the preciousness of entering the 20th century. Very few people have found anything about the century at the moment that is truly enjoyable. We have more than we ever had before, and still want more than we have. We have bought up and taken over in one way or another many independent states, and very few of them are any better off than they were before. They are becoming industrialized, but this is presenting them with another problem. When everybody produces everything, who buys? When we put all the machinery somewhere else for somebody, and he starts manufacturing the goods, who's going to buy it? Can we buy it simply because we put the machinery in? We're already making more of it ourselves than we know what to do with. So all this progress seems to be under the general heading of Bacon's Idols of the Marketplace. The marketplace is world economics. The marketplace is buy, sell, barter. And the marketplace reserves its greatest benefits for those who are able to dominate on the economic level. So we sit back and we think about all these things, and we try to bring these faculties of our own minds into focus to see what we can make it mean, how we are going to interpret and understand the world that we live in. Well, one of the first things we're going to have to do is to escape from the hypnosis of the marketplace. We're going to have to begin to do our own thinking, whether it be good, bad, or indifferent. We are individuals. Each human being has the potential of improving in knowledge and insights. He has the right to fulfill a destiny which will fulfill the faculties that he already possesses. He is capable of more than he is doing. He is capable of solid thinking, but is too lazy, too frightened, or too selfish to do it. He is capable of solving at least his own problems, but instead of that, everything is turned over to governments which seldom, if ever, succeed in solving anything. Therefore, more and more, survival for the individual depends upon dependence upon his own inner resources. He is going to have to know in his own mind what his job is, why he is here, and what he's going to do about it. Now, it's not a case of getting all this out of textbooks. This is one of our difficulties. This, again, is part of the story of the marketplace. Our textbooks are all geared to agree with existing policies which themselves have failed. We are being told again and again the importance of doing things as we always have done them. But gradually, we wear the policy so thin that it falls apart in our hands. There is very little creative thinking being done because there are very few people who want to do it, and there are very few who want to listen if anyone else does it. So, out of it all, there comes the important problem of taking care of ourselves. Not in a selfish sense, not in an egocentric way, but we have been given at birth a body from the infinite. We have been placed here by a power beyond ourselves, and it is our moral duty to do what we can to make this gift that has come, ourselves, make this gift important to the world in which we live. It's not who is going to be the next dictator. It's not the political advancement of the individual that we are primarily considering. The primary consideration is that the individual shall reach a point where he is a normal human being. Now, we have two words that we often use interchangeably, normal and average. normal to a philosophic thinker is a condition of being correct in the face of nature. A normal person is one who is keeping the rules of the game, the rules that are bigger than himself and bigger than any human being. Average is to try and do it as well as the next fellow does it. And if the next fellow does it badly, that excuses us from doing it the same way. Average is to be like everyone else. Normal is to be according to law. Not man-made law, but divine law. Now, what is the normal state of man? The normal state of man is health, physically. He has remarkable recuperative powers, and the body has been given all kinds of protections against the common ailments that affect the flesh. To keep the body normal, the individual has to keep the rules of health. He has to be moderate in his appetites. He must be normal in his activities. He must do things in a way that will protect his own well-being. The moment he goes against his own well-being, his normalcy is damaged. And if he damages it sufficiently, he leaves this world before that which would be his expectancy. So in the body, we have a problem that no one else really can face for us. Yes, we can go to the doctor, and we can get the pills, and the first lot he gives us, we are allergic to and have to throw them away, and with them the $22 we paid for them. Then we try another group, and something else happens. And health is left to someone who is trying to restore the damage we have committed against ourselves. Instead of trying to get over these ailments, there is a new group rising which has a future. Namely, the people who believe we should start well and stay that way, and not permit ourselves to dig our graves with our own appetites. So in a way, the body becomes a symbol of the whole economy. In order to keep the body in good condition, we gradually have to recognize that it is an instrument. The body is a vehicle. It is a cart, as the Indians called it. And this cart, or vehicle, or car, chariot, bicycle, whatever you want to call it, it exists because there is something that it is carrying. The body is not here for its own sake alone. It is here to serve as an instrument for something else. And that something else is the dweller in the flesh, as it was called in India. There is something living in this body. This something is a great mystery also. You ask all the different branches of learning what that something is, and most of them will give different answers. But regardless of what we call it, there is something there. And this something uses the body. Now, body is like any other machinery. It's very valuable. It has many uses. And the dweller in the body must maintain this instrument. And he must maintain it by guarding its functions, maintaining its equipment, having proper control of its fuel, doing everything it can to maintain the length and health of that body. There was an article in the paper not long ago about an automobile that had been driven 1,000,000 miles and was still going. Well, somebody or some bodies took pretty good care of that car, or it wouldn't be here after 1,000,000 miles. There are also individuals who, for no reason that we can specifically point out, intentionally or unintentionally, did something right, and they are also getting along in one way or another. But the majority of human beings, for one reason or another, are ignoring the rules of the game. They do not play life as a serious matter. And at the same time, if they try to make a comedy out of it, they are unfunny for the most part. So we have the body and the party or person or being in the body. Now, the being in the body has to take care of the body, just as we would have to take care of a trained animal or a pet or a very small child. We have to take care of it. And the better we take care of it, the more we learn about it. Most people do not know what the body is until it begins to get sick. They do not know what is inside until it hurts. Therefore, the individual growing up has never had sufficient intelligent understanding of the laws governing his body, any more than he has had an understanding of the laws governing the world he lives in. But he can learn. And he can learn by observation and reflection. He can learn by noting what he does and the consequences. And if the consequences are unpleasant, he doesn't have to do that thing again. He can be completely indifferent, as in the case of the alcoholic or the narcotics addict. He can simply destroy himself. But this is a very sad thing to have happen, for it has taken millions of years to bring the human being to his present biological efficiency, and the individual himself can destroy all in 5 or 10 years of bad habits. Actually, nature, therefore, has a way of punishing the body if it is not well cared for. The punishment is to the flesh, but the inconvenience is to the dweller in the flesh. The body of itself cannot really complain except through pain. But the dweller in the body can see high projects, great purposes, noble aspirations go to pieces if the body becomes ill. Now we have another kind of body, the environment in which we live. The environment determines largely whether a body is going to be properly maintained. And what are we doing to the environment? We are polluting it to our heart's content. We are doing everything we can to gradually make the planet uninhabitable. And we go quietly on our way, absolutely indifferent, assuming, of course, that whatever does happen won't be happening while we're still here. But one of these days, it's going to happen while we're still here. So the body, having its needs, the person in the body looks around to find out how to handle these needs. It tries in every way possible to improve health. And today we probably have a greater emphasis upon health than ever before in modern history. People are trying exercise, diets, nutrition, everything in the order to improve health. And this is a very commendable point of view. But pills are expensive. All these things are costly. And why improve health if the individual himself is not going to do anything with his health? If health is just simply going to allow him to drift along, making all those false decisions he did before, wasting time, and finally, anyway, descending into the inevitable darkness at the end. If health is worthwhile, it's because it helps people to do things that are important in themselves. A life of significant activity. A life in which we are not living simply to take care of the body, but we take care of the body simply because it makes it possible for us to fulfill a human destiny. So we then go on to the emotional side of life. And here we find a serious situation because at this time, apparently, humanity is largely adolescent. Here pressures and problems arise on every hand. Here, hates and fears flow forth from almost every part of existence. And yet the individual, through observation and reflection, has got to put these facts in order. We've got to gradually live in a well-ordered world that we have discovered by the use of well-ordered faculties within ourselves. As long as we live with faculties that have no essential training, we're going to live in a world in which we will never notice anything that is too important. But the more we notice, the more it influences us, the better people we can become. So this has to do with the problem of insight. Insight sort of suggests inner sight. But we are not referring to a clairvoyant faculty. Insight is the result of the faculties with which we are normally equipped being used in the way they are supposed to be used, so that everything that happens has meaning, moral significance, intellectual value, and spiritual authority. Unless we do things to make these dreams come true or to live on these levels, we shall continue to maintain a kind of sanitarium which we call humanity, because nearly everyone is sick in some way. So we're going to start with a little study of insights and see what we can do with them in the time at our disposal. Insight is when you look at the thing, or when you see it happen, you immediately ask yourself, what does this mean to me? This does not necessarily follow that you have been involved in the happening. But if you have seen it, as you might see the unfolding of a motion picture film, you can always say to yourself, what does it mean to me? What can I learn that will make me a better person? Therefore, practically every commonplace incident, pleasant or unpleasant, will reveal meaning. Sometimes that meaning is that it will prove to us that we are unable to handle these activities. The moment some simple thing happens and we are angry, then something is out of control. Insight has failed. Where problems are met with despair, with tears, with hysteria or anger, the impulses, the instincts, the attitudes are wrong. Therefore, we have to try to find how integrity is involved in these occurrences. Insight would help us to benefit from the experiences of others. And if our insight is strong enough, our insight will help other people to benefit from what we can do to straighten out or clarify problems in their experience. Today we have counselors on almost every level, largely due to the fact that people are so interested in doing what they please that they have forgotten entirely to do what they should. And as a result of a series of catastrophes, they are very unhappy about life in general. But everything means something, or it means nothing. It means something if you're awake and nothing if you're asleep. Therefore, a broken home calls upon insight. To most persons, a broken home is a disaster. It is. But no disaster occurs without a cause. And to find out the cause changes a disaster into a lesson. And with life all the way through, unhappy situations must be alchemically transmuted into knowledge. They must become the basis of doing it better next time. The Chinese were among the first to realize that the greatest folly of all is to make the same mistake twice. If you make it once, it may be anyone's fault. If you make it twice, it's your own. You have the right, therefore, to learn from everything that happens, to learn from nature. Probably the peoples with the most strongly developed faculties of perception are primitive people. The perceptive faculties, which are located in the front of the head, directly above the eyebrows, are particularly strong in Aboriginal tribes and are very well marked in American Indians. These perceptive faculties enable the Indian to see long ways, long distances. His eyesight is exceedingly keen. He can do almost as well with his own eyes as we might do with binoculars. But the perceptives are out from himself examining, studying, and considering. And it was the Indian's perspective and his perceptive functions that created his theology. The American Indian does not have nearly as complicated a theology as many more advanced peoples. But he does know nature. He does understand what we put into the Declaration of Independence. nature and nature's God. And perceptives have for us this meaning, nature's God. Everything that we see has meaning in terms of nature. Now, some things in nature, obviously, we have outgrown. Other things in nature, we have not as yet touched at all, practically. But around us, all kinds of natural things are happening. And each one of us is entitled to learn from them. And not to be ashamed to copy the wisdom of simple life or simple creatures who have highly specialized faculties which we have neglected. So we begin by trying to understand the very basic factors of the world in which we live. So we look out some morning or any morning when we wake up and we see an environment. We know we are in a community, large or small, maybe a farming community, maybe a great metropolitan center. But we are looking out upon a world as it is. But we seldom, if ever, pause to try to figure out what that world means. We are going out into something which perhaps we do not approve of, something we do not understand how it got there in the first place, and we do not know where it is going to go. We can think perhaps that we'll hold out until Social Security sets in, and when about that time there's a question as to whether there will be any Social Security or not. Everything is tied up into a pattern of circumstances. Now, if our forefathers, a grandfather, a great-grandfather, was in this spot, he would act differently. Not because he was more learned, but because he had something we're gradually losing, and that is a sense of personal security. He was of the mind that he would make it work. He would make things do. He would fulfill things in a natural way. He would protect values. One of the things that our ancestors always did was to put away something for a rainy day. For most of the older generation, frugality was a virtue. The individual did not overspend himself. He maintained control of his attitudes and his emotions and did that which was well within his common sense for him. He would not live beyond his means. He would not spend everything he had on things he really didn't want. He would not be lifted and moved and twisted and turned by the fashions and avarices of his time. He was, therefore, a fairly solid citizen and generally died with enough money to pay for his funeral. This was a way of life. These people were not dumb. They were not ignorant of values. But they live very close to basic values. And these basic values can still be lived. It is not necessary for anybody to be foolish, even in a generation of extreme folly. Each person can regulate his own affairs with integrity if he so desires. But what is going to make him desire? Well, he is going to find out by his observations and his reflections, the rewards for the various paths that he might take. He is going to know what the probabilities are of any act that he commits. He is going to look around him and see bankruptcies due to extravagance. He is going to see people sick because of bad habits. He is going to find himself impoverished, largely because he has not maintained control of his own values in spending. So, with a little thought, he can begin to take out of his life the things that are useless. Try to get himself back onto a practical foundation. He won't do as well, perhaps, as his grandfather, because the times are more definitely against him. But he can gradually learn why he is here. He can see how he can do many things better. He will find out what he can get along without, which the average American has forgotten entirely. He can gradually build a measure of security into his own life. This security is not in its works, essentially. The individual is not secure simply because he can make such decisions. He is secure because he has trained the decision-making mechanism in his own mind. He has learned to control his thoughts. He has learned to judge things factually. He has gotten over the mysterious kind of ambition which enables him to avoid common sense at the slightest provocation. Little by little, the person gains control of his own life, and by so doing, gradually eliminates a great many of the worries and problems with which he is confronted. Another point that's important in insight and so on is the gradual elevation of the mind in the search for values. Little by little, the individual must outgrow his mistaken levels of living. He won't do it instantly. He is not supposed to do it so precipitately that he will be miserable the rest of his life. But he does begin to realize something that is becoming more and more obvious to us all, namely that there has to be something behind us that's stronger than we are. The individual can gather strength. He can be stronger than he is. But there will always be circumstances around him in which he must depend upon laws, principles, and truths that are more strenuous and more important than himself. Consequently, from the very experiences of insight, from the very testimonies of perception and reflection, the individual begins to see the dim shadow of the world deity, to discover that somewhere out there is a power that can veto any decision made by man. This is something we have not been willing to accept. We have not been willing to allow that there is something that will catch up with us when we make too many mistakes. We can make some mistakes as children and have minor reprimands, but a world, an individual, a society, a cosmos cannot break its own rules without finally receiving the big veto. Something is going to force the correction of that which breaks the rules. Now, some believe that the rules are eternal, that there never was a time when these rules were created.